so you can kill my body. But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Sarah Shays, who is an extraordinary expert who lived for many years in Afghanistan. She'd been a radio reporter on NPR. She's worked with Admiral Mullins at the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 2010, and she's explored what you might call many facets of the experience of Afghanistan. And most recently, she's written a book, and it's a book about corruption in America. It's called On Corruption in America and What is at Stake. And I can think of no better time to have a discussion with my audience about such a topic as right now, as we are awaiting the results of this presidential election. Sarah, thanks for joining me.
I'm so delighted to be with you, Rob.
Let's first talk about, we are in this unusual experience, what I will call the pandemic, and because I work in the realm of ideas, the unmasking, the comfort that everything was in order, the comfort that experts and elites had everything working, what you might call efficiently to get the most for society, all that stuff just seems in tatters. But I'm curious what you see. What is stimulated by this experience? What do you see that you applaud? What do you see that you despise? What do you not see that you wish you saw?
Wow, that's quite the question. And let me start to answer it this way. The last book I wrote was rooted in my Afghanistan experience, but then carried it across to other sort of famously corrupt countries. That book is called Thieves of State: Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. And the fundamental finding that I arrived at was that people subjected to systemic corruption against which there's sort of no civic means of appeal will pivot to extremes. And the extreme that I had been watching unfold before me in Afghanistan was violent religious insurgency. Turns out that it was much more the corruption of the Afghan government and the sort of Western role enabling and reinforcing it that was driving people in their indignation to join the Taliban. That was a factor much more than some abstract religious ideology. And I discovered that the same thing was true across much of the Muslim world, meaning everywhere from Uzbekistan to Nigeria, Boko Haram. It had also driven violent revolutions across North Africa and parts of the Middle East, and since then, Ukraine and, I mean, you name it. And I even sort of went back into history and noticed, you know, I mean, I took a look at the 95 theses. I mean, like, 78 of them are about corruption. I mean, the Protestant Reformation, which, oh, by the way, was not nonviolent, was also largely driven by indignation at corruption. And so, in a strange way, I feel like the United States has been living through a very similar episode, meaning that people subjected to what appears to them to be a remarkably similar business model across Republican and Democratic elites, in spite of the sort of surface contrast and very loud, distracting surface contrast between the two, the underlying business model is fundamentally that of a rigged system. And so you got in 2016, you know, two candidates whom I do not compare, but who were seen both by the sort of establishment, if you will. They were both seen as radical, maverick figures doing incredibly well. And that was Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. I mean, shockingly well. Like, the whole establishment was knocked on its ear by the combined success of those two. And both of them made anti-corruption central to their campaigns. Now, what I discovered in a place like Afghanistan or northern Nigeria was, when people are driven to extremes by this type of situation, they're not, you know, conducting comparative political analysis, right? I mean, they are not rationally sitting down and saying, well, but do we have a marginally better deal under this or under that? Once you're driven into this kind of violent indignation, you vote for a wrecking ball. And very sadly, it is often your head that gets, you know, wrecked, that's in the way of the wrecking ball. And I have friends in northern Nigeria who, you know, regret initial support for Boko Haram. But Boko Haram was extremely bloody in how it, you know, functioned. And it took these friends of mine quite a number of years to regret their original, and they still, I want to say, understand what it was that drove them to have sympathy in the early days for Boko Haram. And I think that it's a very similar situation here. And unfortunately, what I'm concerned about is that the vast spectrum, I want to say the kind of blue-leaning constellation, if you will, is very unwilling to recognize that reality. Instead, has chosen to see Donald Trump as an aberration rather than as a kind of apotheosis of a system that has been building since at the very least 1980. And to me, that is a very dangerous frame of mind, because it means that there is little appetite for examining or repairing the underlying drivers of today's fix that our country is in.
It is interesting, the what you might call the blind spot, in that Donald Trump came in, he beat 15 Republicans and then Hillary Clinton. And his, what you might call, bumper sticker was, the system is rigged, just as you referred to. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. yet, and people took to that. And there was a great deal of hostility, which I'm quite sad to say, related to identity politics, because they didn't view the long, say, struggle of people of color, of women, as something that should be a priority to remedy. They viewed it as a substitute for broad-based economic prosperity.
Exactly.
And
that's
a
very deep point.
And that led to a hostility directed at an African-American president, Barack Obama, as though he was a symptom of what neglected them rather than someone trying. And yet, I worked in finance and in the Dodd-Frank repair and the TARP legislation, because I used to work with the Senate Banking Committee. The way Joseph Stiglitz put it at the time was, we are paying the polluters. The bailout systems fortified Wall Street and left an awful lot of Main Street in tatters. And it's very hard, as you see the Tea Party on the right, Occupy on the left, mortgage overhangs, and big bonuses on Wall Street, not to be able to perceive where some of that rage that led to a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and Donald Trump came from.
That's right. And so you're touching on a couple of really deep issues here. One, let me start where you started, and it was a very profound point you made, about identity politics and how that has played and been reinforced on both sides of the political identity divide. I wrote a paper a couple of years ago in which I looked at half a dozen anti-corruption uprisings in half a dozen countries on different continents. And one part of this paper was devoted to, you know, the empire strikes back, right? Like kleptocratic systems don't take it lying down when they come under attack, finally, by a broad-based civic coalition. And I pursued this thinking much further in On Corruption in America. And in that process, what I discovered is it's absolutely critical for the, if you will, the egalitarian coalition of the many to be consensus-based and cross-cutting. That's essential. And what I discovered in that paper was that the number one and most effective countermove deployed by systemically corrupt elites is to exacerbate identity divides and split that consensus cross-cutting coalition along identity lines.
Yeah. Why don't you and her go fight while I take all the money and you can live in poverty? Yeah.
Thank you. And so what's, again, interesting in this particular moment is when I make that reflection in front of left-leaning folks, they immediately say, yeah, that's exactly what Trump's doing. Yes, he is, but he ain't the only one. He ain't the only one, because then what you have is, you know, frankly, the Democratic-leaning side of our political divide basically turning multicolorism into its identity badge and doubling down on the focus on identity issues almost to the exclusion of basic economic justice. So they're in the very same game. And I find it kind of interesting the degree to which focus on, let's say, diversifying elite institutions like boards of directors and things like that started taking a great deal of precedence over, for example, the fight for a $15 minimum wage, let alone a minimum wage that be pegged to inflation among left-leaning groups. And fundamentally, when you dig down a little bit even further in there, you find an internal conflict of interest, which goes like this. Frankly, I think left-leaning elites have an economic interest in low-paid labor. They have an economic interest in getting their Amazon packages overnight delivered for free, which means essentially slavery conditions for warehouse workers. They've got an economic advantage they've got an economic interest in low-paid janitorial, medical, farm, and other workers. And so there's a contradiction at the heart of their basic, I want to say, policy preferences, which is supposedly concern for people on the economic bottom of this country, and yet a lot of behavior that cuts against the interests of poor and lower middle class Americans. And frankly, I think that the sort of Obama-Trump working class, let's say not college educated voters, they smelled a rat. And again, I'm not trying to say that I agree with the voting selection that they made in 2016, and maybe many of them are, you know, made on Tuesday. However, I do understand it. I do think they were onto something real.
Let me add two thoughts here about both sides of that. The first of which, my friend Robert Borisage made a podcast with me right after the Democratic convention. And to be concise about it, the punchline was this. The Democrats ran a three-day convention telling you how bad Trump was in absolute. They didn't take co-responsibility for the 8 years or partial responsibility along with the Bush administration for the 16 years before Trump was elected that contributed to the despair that led to his election. So they didn't act like they'd done any introspection and that they had a new plan. And the second part is this idea that people don't have to practice what they preach. That the contradiction exactly. between the flowery pronouncements on the left and not delivering may be part of what pushed Donald Trump towards identity politics. Because in my language, simple metaphoric language, he seduced and abandoned the despairing people. He went and said the system is rigged, and then he did tax cuts and deregulation to pay off the riggers. And so I guess what I think, and one of the reasons I was very attracted to exploring your recent book with you, is that it feels to me like both sides are playing all kinds of coping games, because structurally, and now legally structurally, through lobbying, rent-seeking, what have you, the system is corrupt.
I think that's right. And I'd like to pick up on something that you mentioned in your last question, which is how the rigors have been rewarded. So they were absolutely rewarded in the wake of the 2008 economic meltdown. But let's take this even a little bit further and say that notice that many of the people who pounced on the distressed assets of that period are now in government. And by that, I mean, in particular, Steven Mnuchin and Wilbur Ross, but Tom Barrack, who's a close friend of Trump's, who's always been in the shadowy circle around Trump. I mean, these are guys who exploited that crisis, are then, frankly, recidivist criminals because they have been sanctioned for violating, you know, federal law in terms of how they've run their real estate properties. They are in government at the moment when a new crisis hits, which is the COVID-19 crisis. And so not only were they rewarded then, they were then given control of nearly unlimited spigot of money. And what I find so interesting is that the United States is so riveted on the political divide, the red-blue divide, that it looks, for example, at the Federal Reserve as, you know, oh, this wonderful thing. Again, in particular, I'm talking about the sort of left-leaning expert community. I mean, there was a reverential interview of Jay Powell on my alma mater NPR not too long ago. I just couldn't believe it when, you know, so sure, again, Jay Powell has said some things that Democrats like to hear, like, oh, Congress should pass more stimulus. People really need the unemployment help. So Jay Powell has been saying that while he's been doing what? He's been taking the government printing press, except you don't even need to print money anymore. You can just create electronic signals. And he's taken that power to bring forth money out of nothing, to inject trillions of dollars into the corporate bond market. Now, I hear again, supposedly intelligent people in the left-leaning mainstream media that I tend to consult, I mean, scratching their heads for months on end about why the stock market has been doing so well, with very few exceptions, you know, a couple of days here and there, but it's been doing remarkably well while we're in, you know, an economic freefall. Well, the answer is kind of simple. When you're dumping $6 trillion, bailing out corporate debt, which was incurred, again, in very vulture capitalist ways in the wake of 2008. I mean, so you have both the rigors of the system who were rewarded then, they're being rewarded again now, and no one's even noticing it.
call that the mother of all moral hazards. And
I mean, and it's moral hazard, but I'd like to bring the analysis a little bit closer to a more, I want to say, there's agency here. These are networks of people who interact together. They're individuals whom you can name. You can go on, I think it's called the Revolving Door Project, and just look at the superhighway linking the Federal Reserve to BlackRock, which is running these corporate bond purchases. So let me just walk you through in terms of a network functioning and bending the rules in order to serve itself rather than the American public. So the Federal Reserve decides it's going to do these bond buys. The Board of Governors assigns the New York Fed to do the buys. The New York Fed does not itself buy the bonds. Instead, it wants to contract out that activity. But it chooses not to contract out itself. What it does is create a shell company domiciled in the state of Delaware. Now, isn't that interesting? The Federal Reserve of New York is based in the state of New York. Why would it form a company? It's a limited liability company. Why would it form that company not in the state of New York? Well, doesn't it just turn out that Delaware has the most significant and important secrecy protections for companies, right? So that means once it's formed a private company in Delaware, there is absolutely no visibility on what that company is doing. And what that company did was then sign a no-bid contract with BlackRock, the largest money manager on Wall Street, which, as I just said, has a super highway of personnel connecting it between the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department. That's what I'm talking about when in On Corruption in America I describe horizontally integrated kleptocratic networks. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
A friend, Dennis Kelleher, who runs Better Markets and who worked very closely with me on all the TARP and Dodd-Frank issues, he said, what we're going to have to do now is have another bailout system for the people. We'll call it the Department of Economic Security, because what we're doing now is protecting assets, not jobs and people, with our central bank.
100%. And I do feel a little embarrassed to be walking through these kinds of details with you, who wrote the book on it. But for me, it was a pretty breathtaking
realization. It's haunting. It's absolutely haunting.
Very haunting. Yeah. And then back to the identity divide issue, what's so fascinating is that because the Federal Reserve is purportedly independent of quote-unquote partisan politics, it is seen in this polarized moment as being therefore intrinsically good. But what we've forgotten to ask is whether the Federal Reserve is independent from Wall Street, and that it emphatically is not.
Go back to my dear late friend William Grider, whose book The Secrets of a Temple brought that to the forward, to the attention of the world in the 1980s, around the time of the 86, 87 changing of leadership from Volcker to Greenspan, attempts to repeal Glass-Steagall, savings and loan bailout, and obviously the 87 stock market crash. You know, late in his life, Paul Volcker was very vocal. He was a friend of mine, and I did a lot of work with the Volcker Alliance and INET. And he talked about how independence from whom was going to lead to a place where the public would not tolerate this notion of the independence of the central bank any longer. And I've wondered if we're getting closer to that in light of this, which you might call protection of the donors approach that the Federal Reserve engaged in. Now, I will say this. I don't think they had a choice not to extend credit. The question is who they extended it to.
That's exactly right. Who they extended it to and on what terms to whom. So they also had a facility to extend credit to cities and states. And isn't it interesting that the terms of those loans were less favorable than the terms of the loans extended to corporations? And that or purchase of bonds, it's a similar, I mean, that's essentially a loan. But that's the real issue. And what distresses me is no one's talking about it. I mean, it's as though this is not happening.
What do you call a Green New Deal, a transformation of the energy and climate preservation systems.
Absolutely. 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 And then, you know, you get into, anyway, yeah. I mean, I think we've kind of labored this terrain probably long enough. There are other internal contradictions, even on climate issues, where it's true that again, the sort of left, broader self-identified left-leaning constellation talks endlessly about science when talking about climate, but really doesn't talk about jobs because they fundamentally don't care about jobs. But jobs are absolutely critical and are the, I mean, just as you said, a Green New Deal would create new forms of honorable and pride-inducing employment that are just beyond our imagination, but Democrats haven't really talked about that.
In your article with Lynn Paramore on the INET website, you talked about the word myth and the dismissing nature. But there is our mutual friend Bill Moyers has spent a lot of time with Joseph Campbell and exploring this. There are timeless truths embedded in myths. They are designed to be a penetrating wake-up call when false consciousness prevails. And I know early in your book, there's a beautiful sequence, you might call tours, around the myth of the love of money. I've always heard money is the root of all evil, and I always think it was a little more subtle than that. The love of money was the root of all evil.
That's what the actual gospel line is, and it's better than that. It's the love of money is a root of all evil. It's a very accurate, I think, statement. Thank you for asking that, because that's exactly right. I mean, myths are deeply true. They are, and I use actually just because of the disparaging overtones that the word has collected of late, I also use the word sacred stories. Myths and sacred stories are the way our species has considered itself and its place in the world for tens of thousands of years. And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned Joseph Campbell, because in one of his most famous books, Hero with a Thousand Faces, I mean, it is so stunning that I remember the page number. It's on page 11. He goes into a riff on Minos, whom I do not discuss in On Corruption in America, but he uses his description of Minos to talk about the timeless psychological characteristics of the tyrant, of the sort of mythical or archetypical tyrant. And it's a two-page riff, and it's very detailed. And I'm reading this thing, and it is exactly the psychological portrait of Donald Trump. And it was rereading that page that I said, oh my goodness, we've turned our backs on myth. And therefore, we are being condemned to live our myths. I mean, the figures who stride across the stage of world events today, I mean, they could come right out of, you know, Homer or Hesiod or, you know, you name it. And that is really what caused me to decide that I was going to take mythology really seriously in this book. And so I thought about what are some of the, you know, most important myths that have to do with money. And Midas was the first one that came to mind. And, you know, Midas was the guy who did a god a favor. The god offered him one single wish, and Midas had no trouble at all. Let everything I touch turn to gold. Well, it took him about maybe 7 or 8 seconds of enjoying that to realize what a terrible thing he had just done. And I think that Nathaniel Hawthorne brings it most vividly to life by giving Midas a daughter. She sees his distress when he suddenly realizes he can't drink anything. He can't eat that beautiful, crunchy apple he just pulled off a tree because it turned to gold. And he's horrified, and she comes running over to comfort him, and she was the one thing he adored, you know, maybe even more than gold. And he bends down to kiss her forehead, and by gum, she turns into metal. The deep meaning of this myth is about how the infatuation with money causes us to transform items of irreplaceable value into what amounts to lifeless metal, or today, to zeros in bank accounts. And the really, you know, what I ended up doing in On Corruption was intersect sacred stories with science to see if there was any insight to be gained. And what I found, I had no idea this was going to happen. I sort of looked into Midas and I said, okay, let me look into the origin of money. Well, by gum, it turns out that money was invented there was a Midas, and he ruled basically where and when money was invented. So the Midas myth is actually about money, which later Greek thinkers, not much later, like in the next 100 years, the great flourishing in Athens of philosophy and theater and, you know, art, those folks really grappled with it. The great playwrights and Aristotle. And Aristotle grappled with it a lot. And he basically made a distinction, a qualitative distinction, between amassing money and gaining what he called natural wealth. And I would like to make the same distinction, which is to say there is nothing wrong with aspiring to a decent, honorable life in which you have enough material goods to make you comfortable, able to share, able to enjoy enough leisure to be creative and be thoughtful. And what Aristotle was saying is that non-monetary forms of wealth have a natural limit to them. And I think it's really important to kind of take that in, that when you count your wealth in flocks of sheep and fig trees, you can't have an infinite amount of them. And you have to tend them. You have to lavish some care and effort on them. Money is different. And once money becomes the source of social status, the exclusive yardstick by which we measure our social standing, then you're into a race with no finish line. But now let's go back to Midas. That race with no finish line is not, you know, it has consequences, because you have to transform items of irreplaceable value into money in order to participate in that race. And that means the land, what's on the land, what's under the land, human creativity, human labor, human relationships, all of those things get monetized and converted into zeros without any endpoint. That's the situation we're in. And then you say, okay, once a human society has turned itself over to people infected with the Midas disease, inevitably they start linking themselves together into coalitions or networks in order to rig the rules of society to allow them to continue running this race. Now, within their rigged rules, they may be competitive, but they are very much aligned with each other in the rigging of the rules. And that's the situation that gave rise to another sacred story that I touch on, which is Jesus and the money changers. And there again, so that's four lines of gospel in four different sacred books. Almost identical. And man, there is so much in those four lines of gospel. So I did the same move. I did the same thing. I went and looked at the science, the archaeology. I discovered that the Temple of Jerusalem was the most magnificent building east of Rome. I had no idea. The thing was huge. It, you know, towered over the surrounding landscape. It was gold-plated. I read that thing and I said, you have got to be kidding me. You mean you've got Trump Tower in the middle of Jerusalem and you've got a military base and you've got the money changers, which is essentially Wall Street. You've got a bank, you know, where money is held. So you kind of have Fort Knox there too. You've got the seat of government, the seat of religion, and, you know, and this military base. So it's some unholy combination of, you know, Washington, D.C., Wall Street, Fort Knox, the Vatican, and, you know, the military base in Qatar or something like that. That's what Jesus took on. What's really fascinating to me is the sort of combination of what he did. He performed a pretty dramatic act. He strode up the steps of that temple and he started throwing the furniture around. You know, he waves a whip around in the air. It's really dramatic. It's not violent, however. He doesn't kill anyone. What he's doing is holding people up to shame, in a sense. And sure enough, he is surrounded by a crowd of his followers who were, quote, spellbound at his teaching. You betcha they were spellbound. So let me dwell on that crowd for a second. The only way to curb the coalition of, I want to say, super rich elite that's rigging the system in their favor, the only way to curb it is with a cross-cutting, numerous, egalitarian coalition. It has to cut across all the identity divides, or else the coalition can just divide it up, as we talked about before. And so let's think back at Love Thy Neighbor. I mean, all of that teaching, basically, Jesus is creating the cross-cutting coalition. Love Thy Neighbor is about let's join together across the identity divides. He breaks bread. That replicates the very earliest egalitarian, human egalitarian practice and then sacred practice of sharing of the meat. That's how you keep the egalitarian coalition together. You share the collectively hunted food equally. So he does all of that, brings the egalitarian coalition, and then shows them what they need to curb, which is to say the corrupt, kleptocratic network, if you will, or the corrupt coalition of super rich, or you name it, right? That group up there that's running the political economy, political religious economy, in this case. That is the moment, according to all four Gospels, that the kleptocrats decide they have to kill Jesus. The super rich, the second he does that, love thy neighbor by itself is fine. Split up loaves and fishes among your followers, you have at it. But you come up here and bring the cross-cutting coalition against us, you have to die. And I found that just chillingly revelatory about the situation we're in now.
You mentioned earlier that the in embodied in myths is a certain truth. But I recently had a guest on. His name was Eugene McCarraher. And the name of his book is The Enchantment of Mammon. And what he has said is that after the Protestant Revolution and the 30 Years' War and all of that bloodiness, the resort to antiseptic, abstract, intellectual ideas and the application of the, what I'll call, scientific mode of discourse to the social science and social environment led to what people called, even up through Max Weber, the secularization of society, as if religion had disappeared. But what McGarrett said is No, we have the same yearnings, the same religious desires and impulses related to our fears and uncertainty in the future and what have you, and looking for a direction, a way forward to do good. But what happened was we attached those things to the market, to money, to wealth. And that's why he calls the enchantment of mammon. And so I guess what I'm asking you is, how do we discriminate between timeless myths that send us in the right direction and the magnetic energy of a false god, like the worship of a tool called a market?
I mean, when I talk about, I guess what I'm saying is timeless myths are timeless. And, you know, you're talking about ones that recur. And there again, Joseph Campbell has been incredibly helpful to all of us in showing us that, you know, for example, the dead and resurrected God is an absolute trope of mythologies the world over. Therefore, there is something, you know, to it. And so you start looking at, those patterns and see, you know, where you can be guided. But very often what myths are particularly about is how to help people who have been distracted by, you know, things that masquerade as myths. So I think that I'm not sure, you know, how to answer that question in terms of, I want to say, almost literary analysis. But
it's important to understand the importance of people like Joseph Campbell, because when you see across cultures, he's got books about Occidental, Oriental, things about India, things about Japan, what have you. And when you see these recurring patterns, and you see the historic episodes where they do lead to good and prosperity and what we might call today social sustainability, that's the wheat. And the chaff is that should be removed are the false myths that don't practice what they preach, that don't take us to the place. And so being aware that in the context of our debate, there are all kinds of people selling snake oil is important.
Yeah. In other words, I would say what real deep-rooted mythology helps us do is see through the false claims of almost divine omnipotence of certain things that do not whose claims don't stand up. And so why I use mythology is I just found it an incredibly useful way of seeing past the distracting surface level of what's happening today. Yeah. It almost gave me X-ray eyes. And so I would move on to the next one, which is the Hydra, the many-headed kind of serpent-like figure, also from Greek mythology, that I use as one of a couple of metaphors to describe what I mean by kleptocratic networks. And I've already been using that expression, kleptocratic network. It's a little bit of a mouthful and a kind of wonky term. So, you know, I kind of use a couple of different ways of describing this phenomenon interchangeably, and that may not be as precise as possible, but I also do believe that some people will latch, you know, one of them might work for them, whereas another one might work for somebody else. And so the Hydra is a mythological metaphor that I use. I also use the expression kleptocratic network, also dominator coalition. you know, back to the sort of evolutionary thing that I mentioned before, that, you know, as Homo sapiens, one of the cool things we did was become a whole lot more egalitarian than our primate relatives. And we did that for, you know, couple hundred thousand years until we discovered agriculture and kind of started reverting to our ape-like hierarchical tendencies. And the people who try to make that happen are the dominator coalition, or, you know, today the kind of kleptocratic network. And what I mean by this, or the Hydra. So the Hydra is really interesting because it's this beast with a bunch of different heads. Now, if you just look at the heads, you think that each head is independent and striking separately. And I think that that's what that's the distracting surface image that we often have. So we look at, let's say, a Steven Mnuchin and a George Soros. And on the surface, these two are antithetically opposite people, right? Because one is painted blue and the other is painted red. Then it turns out that, golly gee, Steven Mnuchin worked for George Soros when he got his start, and that, you know, when he first left Goldman Sachs, he gets in, you know, he goes to work for George Soros. And then when he launches his own private equity firm, guess who the number one investor is? George Soros. And then we start looking at how George Soros made all of his money in the 1990s. And he did it by speculating against, you know, global currencies, which helped bring down, frankly, the economies of half a dozen countries in the late 1990s. So you suddenly see, wow, these two heads, which look like completely independent and even opposing figures, turn out to be joined to the same body. And that is so. So in the middle of On Corruption in America, what I do is first of all, try to walk people through what I mean by a network. And I really learned about that in Afghanistan, where I would be treated to, you know, intelligence briefings, you know, showing me network maps of Taliban, you know, little Taliban groups, right? And you had this guy who was kind of the leader, and here's, and via tapping his telephone and confidential informants who said, oh yeah, his cousin is also in the gang and blah, blah, blah. They would build these maps that showed, you know, had lines connecting different figures. And then I would ask them, well, have you done the network map on the governor of the province and the local companies that are implementing a lot of the development, you know, projects? Have you done that network map? And of course, they hadn't. And what I discovered there and have discovered since is that these kleptocratic networks are woven across the sectors and political parties that, again, distractingly seem to be separate in our broader understanding of society. And so even that expression that we like to use when we talk about American corruption, the revolving door, I think is actually misleading, because it suggests that you have an individual who, for personal reasons, is pushing a door between two sectors, business and government, that are otherwise separate. Whereas instead, what you have is an integrated network that includes individuals who, for a while, serve in public office and then go back to their positions in the private sector and vice versa. And so it's not like a door that an individual pushes. Rather, it's a network that is strategically placing its personnel for a period in the public sector to bend the rules and hollow out the guardian institutions in ways that serve the network. And then they get to cash in the private sector. And then they can go to the nonprofit sector, the philanthropies, and, you know, burnish their image as being, you know, wonderful stalwarts, you know, helpers of society and the arts, right? Then they go back to making their money and often will be peddling the influence that they've gained in the other two sectors to make some money or get insider information so that, you know, for example, the contemporary art market is full of these individuals, including, for example, the Mnuchin family. And so the Hydra turns out to be a great metaphor for that. The last point being that, the really diabolical thing about the Hydra is that you chop off one head and two more grow. And I have seen this the world over, where I've been watching, particularly in recent years, where uprisings have taken place against kleptocratic networks in power, and they've been incredibly successful in places like Egypt or Tunisia or Guatemala or South Korea in toppling corrupt governments. The problem is that there's a tendency to focus on the individual at the top, chop off the head, or maybe two or three or five heads. And what happens is the network invariably sprouts new heads. And so while chopping off some heads is definitely necessary, it's a part of any solution to this very daunting problem. And that means voting them out of office, and it means punishing them by punishments that matter, not, you know, fining the companies that they've already looted, but rather fining them or putting them in jail. That does need to happen. It is necessary, but it is not sufficient.
Yes.
That was the importance to me.
It's what the cultural and social anthropologists call regicide, that when things go bad, they got to chop somebody's head off to offer to the gods so that we can acknowledge our misdeeds and move on.
Right. And then, of course, the network sprouts other heads. But I think the important thing to understand, those are a couple of important things to understand about how the networks operate, that they are integrated across public and private and even out and out criminal sectors. Okay, so if you look at the opioid crisis, for example, the intersections between public, private, and criminal strands are unmistakable. But then the other thing to do is really drill down into what do the networks do, or what do network members do when they are in positions of public power, of public office? And what they do is weaponize the agencies and institutions of government to serve the network and not the people. And that means, in particular, the law writing power, the power to write the rules, the power to enforce the rules, and that means the justice sector, the power to interpret the rules, that's also the justice sector. And then, those are some examples, and you can drill down into more specific agencies and things like that. The revenue-bearing agencies are very important to capture, and that means in every country, defense ministries. It also means the financial services industry and its regulators, and energy and high-end real estate, and all of the regulations around those things they show up in every single country that I have looked at overseas, and they show up right again here. But then the other, and I've kind of alluded to that, when you can't actively weaponize an agency or institution of government, you start hollowing it out. You start crippling it. You start making it impossible to perform its duties, for it to perform its duties. Sorry. You start making it impossible for that agency to perform its duties. And so in Afghanistan, for example, I saw, very talented and courageous prosecutors being, first of all, having their salaries wildly slashed. Salaries that had been $900 a month going down to $200 a month, like that. And then, you're in the middle of an insurgency, they get, assigned out to provinces that are infested with Taliban. There are ways that you can make it hard for people to do their job. I was painfully amused to learn, I don't know if you remember when Scott Pruitt was administrator of the EPA, he had around-the-clock security detail. Well, I worked for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He didn't have an around-the-clock security detail. And the security detail he had was two people. It wasn't a phalanx. Pruitt had a phalanx, but guess who they were? They were criminal investigators. They were not security personnel. They were criminal investigators who had been detailed to babysit the boss. Well, it's pretty hard to go around chasing bad guys when you have to babysit the boss. So that's one of the types of ways that you can cripple or disable um, a relatively independent instrument of state function. And then I do go into some of the tactics and counter moves the same way I had for foreign countries, like identity divides, but also secrecy is a big one. Secrecy and I want to say obfuscation, just confusing people. And we've been seeing that in spades in this country. And it's interesting to see the very same personnel involved in fooling us about the dangers of sugar, fooling us about the dangers of tobacco, and fooling us about the dangers of man-caused climate change. And I want to go beyond just the issue of CO2 to broader environmental devastation and its impacts on, you know, the viability, frankly, of Homo sapiens life on Earth. And so the Hydra was a very, I think, helpful metaphor for trying to walk through some of those specific realities of how kleptocratic networks have been functioning in the United States across the political divide. In particular, I want to say, in this current period, since about 1980.
Let me ask you a question related to the purpose of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. One of the Hydra heads that you refer to in your book and also in your article with Lynn is in the realm of ideas.
Yeah.
How universities, foundations, and others, I think you refer to them as enablers.
Yep.
And they can, I've often said that there are several corruptions in economics. One is the corruption of commission, doing marketing rather than analysis for the powerful. The second is the corruption of omission, staying silent because you'd have to confront the powerful. The third is what I'll call the ritual of talking in code in the monastery, demonstrating your skills on irrelevant things so that you don't get into the controversy or cause your university's development department any heartburn or what have you. And then the fourth, which I think is inherent in a anxious and uncertain society, which is the corruption of we might call false certainty, pretending to know things you don't know and becoming essentially a demagogue. But when I look at, I did an interview a few months back with Anand Giriharadas on his book.
Oh, yeah, what a great philanthropy. Book.
And this idea of how ideas and the pretense of rituals or working papers or peer-reviewed journals and all these kind of things become part of this network. I'm curious how, in your exploration, how you see all of that.
I am so glad that you asked me that question, Rob. So one of the ways that kleptocratic networks, you know, deploy their tactic of obfuscation is through making fundamentally simple concepts sound just impossibly complex through euphemisms, I mean, using vocabulary that doesn't mean anything or means something impenetrable, complex writing style and things like that. And that keeps a lot of people in business. And I think there are a lot of colluders who participate in that because their own, you know, not super rich, but comfortable salaries depend on it. And so I think your question touches on two different things that need to be done. One, I was really struck in looking back at the last time that America and much of the industrialized world, in fact, was in the, you know, similarly in the grip of kleptocratic networks, which was, I would say, in the period from roughly 1870 until roughly 1935. I looked at the Farmers Alliance, which was one of the kind of resistance movements, and I was really struck that this was a movement that was based around public education or civic education. So the Farmers Alliance had, you know, traveling lecturers who would go out to public schools in the middle of nowhere. I mean, we're talking, you know, the very late 19th century, where people are going to their little village schoolhouse in covered wagons from I don't know how many miles away to listen to these lectures that included a lot of really specific farming, you know, techniques and things like that, but then very sophisticated, what, you know, even today you'd call really sophisticated examinations of economic factors, like what is the role of the monetary supply, just to give you one, which I don't think there's a lot of Americans who would want to sit down to listen for an hour about, okay, what is the difference really between having a gold standard and having a flexible paper currency? Like, what is the difference in impact here? How does that affect, you know, the prices that you get for commodities and things like that? And they, you know, and so I started fantasizing about a kind of online resource bank or some way of, you know, again, self-education in some of the fundamental underlying concepts that would help equip ordinary citizens, no matter what, you know, whether they've been to college or not, with enough of the fundamental concepts to kind of poke holes in this tyranny of the experts, in this all of this gobbledygook that is used to camouflage some pretty basic facts of life. And so I would love it if iNet could do that. I'm afraid that, again, you guys are to some extent captured in an overeducated ecosystem. And to be even credible in that ecosystem, you have to express yourself in certain ways. But that's definitely a direction that I think needs to be gone in. Secondly, and this is another task I'd love to, you know, give you guys. Think about the Federalist Society, which was founded initially by, you know, a couple of conservative Yale law students, but immediately got glommed onto by the sort of justice branch members of the kleptocratic networks, in particular the right-leaning, you know, networks. It was brilliant. And what it was about was, how do we educate and groom a whole generation, a whole crop of justice sector professionals to go out and colonize, you know, the courts, but not just the courts, the other just Department of Justice type jobs and whatnot. And I'm wondering, we need the same law schools, et cetera, right, to then continue. You're exactly right. Law schools to both colonize and reformat justice sector professionals. I think we on the, you know, I want to say amorphous left, need a similar type of institution for financial services jobs. And that means for Treasury, the Fed, and the regulatory agencies. And that means finding left-leaning, you know, economics and finance students and really nurturing and networking and cultivating them. And I don't really see an institution that's playing that role on the economics and finance side of life the way that the Federal Society is doing it on the justice sector side of life.
But I have to introduce you to the Young Scholars Initiative of the iNet, which is holding its plenary. And they have about 14,000 members worldwide.
Wow, fantastic.
They've been at it since 2012 in Berlin when it was founded. But they are building what you might call strength of community, fortifying each other, becoming sophisticated about what you might call the path of life as an economist, where you go through the peer-reviewed journals and the siren songs of temptation of consulting with powerful people, for et cetera, all the refractory influences on truth. And I'm quite... How do you say? I'd love to have you come talk with them. I think it would be very, very good for them to explore that. The sense that I have in listening to you reminds me of Miles Horton, who was a PhD, I think, in anthropology from Chicago, who founded the Highlander Center.
Oh, yes.
And Miles really went down to, with a tremendous humility, and he essentially said, before I can do anything, he's got an autobiography I read many years ago called The Long Haul. But he said, before I can do anything, I got to learn what I should be doing, and I got to go talk to the people in the hills in Tennessee.
Right.
And so he didn't go in there as a know-it-all. He went in there as a learn-it-all, as a prelude to his time. Also, I remember Bill Moyers had a beautiful 2-hour interview with Miles when I was reading about when I was reading the autobiography. I learned more from watching that as well. But I see.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right, and I just like to put a bookmark there, because in the wake of the 2016 election, I was desperate for someone to go out and do some very serious focus group research on, you know, like regular people. Because what I kept experiencing from the kind of anti-corruption community based in Washington, D.C., was we need to go explain to people this, that, and the other thing. And I said, shut up. We need to go and listen to people. And in fact, even formal focus groups, I didn't really believe in. What you really needed was a much more open-ended conversation with regular people. And I had been doing this, you know, all around the world. And learning that people's concerns and definitions and understanding of corruption was almost identical, as I say, across half a dozen continents. And I was sure that if you could get the environment and the conversation, I want to say, non-threatening enough, you would find the same thing was true of ordinary Americans across the political spectrum. But what I kept hearing from left-leaning elites in Washington was, oh, Trump supporters understand corruption to mean this. And I would say, like, would you shut up and go listen to them? And they were basing their understanding on much more formal polls, you know, with prefabricated questions, and very occasionally with formal focus groups. And I just, from my experience in the developing world, that's not going to work. First of all, the very fact that you are conducting a formal poll or a focus group of this type, and how you dress when you walk into the room and whatnot, is going to signal a lot of where you stand on the political spectrum. And that is going to automatically elicit reactions from your public. Again, polling, you could not conduct polls in Afghanistan because the Taliban don't poll. Therefore, by definition, if someone's conducting a poll, they're on the other side, and people are going to be really careful about how they answer. And that was just obvious to me. And I think the exact same thing applies today. And incidentally, I think that might shed some light on why the polls have been so desperately off in 2016 and this year. And so I couldn't agree with you more about the necessity for open-ended, unpreconceived listening to regular people. I mean, if we're talking about a coalition that believes in democracy, which is to say every human being is created equal and the wisdom of the crowd is likely to deliver better outcomes, if those two articles are articles of faith, then they require the listening without preconceived ideas to regular, ordinary Americans.
One of my favorite books is called Seasons of Grace by John O'Neill and Alan Jones. And in that book, he talks about a time when Alan Jones, who ran Grace Cathedral, saw a poster about family life in England. And in it, the parent is standing over a teenager, and he says, what you need is a good listening to. Not a good talking to, but a good listening to. And
I love it.
So how do I say that? What I'm inching us toward is the extraordinary experience that I've had in knowing Michael Sandel. His new book, The Tyranny of Merit, is about how the common good is sacrificed to the career interests or the vanities of the alleged expert, who tends to, as they used to say, it was a reference to Henry Kissinger, that he kissed uphill and pissed downhill. That he was the expert there to please the Rockefeller family to get appointments and chairs at Harvard and all these things. And, you know, I didn't know Henry Kissinger, so I can't pass any judgment, but I do get the sense that what Sandel was talking about, and what's remarkable is he's at Harvard University where you went to school. He's essentially saying these people don't believe that because of your training or somehow you're better suited to represent us, even in a complex system, because they think the force fields of corruption and ambition, the siren songs of temptation, have become so strong.
So what I find really interesting is where I've gone on this, even in recent years. I mean, you know, a few minutes ago, I was talking about kleptocratic networks that are really engineering the rigging of the system and that cross all of these different divides. Those are very small coalitions, and they are extremely handsomely remunerated by and for the system rigging that they do. Let me take that again and say, these are very small coalitions that are making out ridiculously well. And by that, I mean they're essentially the billionaires or the super rich. They cannot keep winning without a much larger cushion of, and you used a word earlier on, a much larger cushion of enablers. And those enablers, again, you can sort of put them in different categories, right? There are the really active enablers, the facilitators, if you will. And these are the lawyers who argue their cases in Supreme Court or wherever. They're the registered agents who form their shell companies in secrecy jurisdictions. They are the public relations firms that burnish their images and whatnot. But then you have what you could even call sort of soft enablers. And these are the think tanks, the museums, and the universities that take their money and that also play along through this sort of false meritocracy ideology. And this gang, this soft cushion, they're bought off way cheaper. You know, they don't need millions and billions of dollars. You just have to give them a pretty cushy job with a lot of job security and a six-figure salary. And that is enough of the pie to keep them, number one, from ever challenging the system, and number two, to keep them perpetuating the system by allowing donors to burnish their images and also keeping up this barrier of obfuscating language and, as you say, peer-reviewed journal articles and all of that kind of stuff. And impossibly selective barriers to entry. And indeed, they don't represent ordinary Americans. They represent themselves. They feel largely uncomfortable in the company of ordinary Americans. And I think in the world of ideas, this is really dangerous. As education is being increasingly sort of hijacked by this enabling class, education itself is becoming an object of contempt on the part of ordinary Americans. And let me take you back to Boko Haram. Boko Haram, which Westerners were horrified at because, oh, these horrible terrorists are attacking schools. It means they're against education as a value. That wasn't really true. The point is that in Nigeria, education was a corrupt intake valve into one of the most corrupt sectors of society, which was the civil service. The civil service was the linchpin through which the kleptocratic networks, you know, extracted revenue streams from the state. And so the public school system was seen as part and parcel of this whole rigged system. And I think that dangerously in the United States, that's increasingly becoming the case. And I think that COVID is going to prove to have had a devastating accelerator effect on this process, because once again, the public sector has been starved, allowing private business interests to play even more of a life-saving role in institutions of higher learning. And that means they get to call the shots. They get to shape the content and purpose of these institutions. Whereas, you know, public education is for everyone. There's another really somber takeaway from On Corruption in America. I went back and looked at the last period when the United States and the rest of the industrialized world was as completely in the grip of kleptocratic networks as it is today. And that was the period from very approximately 1870 until very approximately 1935. And I wanted to find out what broke the grip of the networks back then. And that's why I looked at these really creative, innovative, courageous, persistent resistance movements. Many of the solutions that they came up with were eventually adopted. But what was quite concerning to me was they were never adopted while those resistance movements were still alive. First, the resistance movements were crushed, and they were crushed mercilessly. Then, eventually, some of their ideas got enacted, everything from the eight-hour day to a flexible currency to direct election of senators, right? What was it that cracked open the possibility for some of those reforms to be enacted? And the conclusion I came to was that it was repeated global calamity. It was not just World War I, not just a depression. It was World War I plus the depression plus World War II. That is, two global conflagrations that included two genocides, mass starvation in Europe, the use of the nuclear bomb, and a pandemic that, you know, puts this one to shame, plus a global economic meltdown. That is the degree of disaster that it took to kind of develop enough of the sort of disaster solidarity ethos that always kicks in when broad groups suffer calamity. That disaster survivor ethos kicked in and kicked into enough of the elite to make it at least somewhat permeable to these resistance movements. It's not that the reforms weren't still hard fought, but at least it was a possibility of them taking hold. And I find that really frightening when we look at our current predicament, because we look a heck of a lot like the late 19th century. We've had economic meltdown after economic meltdown, several of which you have been involved in cleaning up. We even had a really parallel terrorist attack and reaction. I've been thinking more deeply about the Wall Street bombing of 1920, in which a spectacular bomb went off right in front of the office of J.P. Morgan, almost identically to where the 9/11 terrorist attack struck. And the reaction, the situation was identical. And the aftermath was identical in that back then in 1920, what happened was a huge Red Scare. Oh my God, the anarchists, the Reds, they're going to kill us all. They're an existential threat. And that's what everybody got scared about. And in the wake of 9/11, the same thing happened. Oh my God, the terrorists are an existential threat to the United States. Everyone, all hands on deck to fight the terrorist threat, including me. I mean, I didn't fight it the same way, but I reacted very similarly that this is the most important issue and let me go running off or halfway around the world to Afghanistan, when in fact the existential threat was right there on Wall Street in both cases. And in both cases, that terrorist action and the distraction that it provided allowed the kleptocratic networks to drive the car off the road. And we had the crash of 1929 and the crash of 2008, you know, less than a dozen years later in each case. And so I see us today as on a very, very similar course to the course that the industrialized world was on in the late 19th and very early 20th centuries. And unfortunately, in a way, I don't see our current calamities, neither 2008 nor the current COVID pandemic, neither 2008 nor the current COVID pandemic, as being significant enough global calamities to generate the type of disaster survivor ethos that really is needed to fix this thing. And that, you know, explains for me the urgency that I feel. I'm like, guys, we have to generate that kind of solidarity and that sense of absolute determination that people experience in the immediate aftermath of an earthquake in order to ward off these calamities. Because this century's versions of the early 20th century calamities are going to be so overwhelming, they're going to be indescribable. And so that's really the plea with which I end this book. We all need to get into this fight.
Yeah. Well, let me say, we started out and we talked a little bit about what you might call the insensitivity of these networks and the production of Donald Trump as a, what am I call, symptom of despair. Now you and I are talking as they're counting the votes in a very close electoral vote count. And I guess I'd ask, what do you see happening if Biden, who's considered a centrist Democrat, wins vis-a-vis Trump? You know, you were talking about people feeling justified in looting. I know some centrist Democrats say if we get rid of Trump, we ought to be able to go, you know, just fill our pockets because of the sigh of relief we created by overcoming that. But there are a lot of people who understand, I think, in light of the pandemic, that the situation in society is not sustainable, that the questions of climate, the questions of inequality, the questions of deterioration of education, and the questions of the strength and power of these concentrated networks are all dangerous in the long term. How do you see if Biden comes to power, and what do you say we as a people have to do?
So my concern is that much of the Democratic Party elite and establishment is entertaining a childish fantasy that if we can just turn back the clock to 2015, you know, if we can just replicate the Obama-Biden administration, everything is going to be fine again. We'll wake up from this nightmare and none of this will ever have happened. Frankly, I really think that's a lot of what is going on behind the Biden-Harris ticket. It's as close to a carbon copy of Obama-Biden as you could possibly get. And I think that is a dangerous fallacy. Therefore, rather than making a prediction, I'd like to make a plea, which is that people who understand that that's a dangerous fallacy, and I'm afraid that we are in a minority, because it's always more comfortable to have a fairy tale fallacy, you know, guiding you, than it is to kind of take a good hard look in the mirror. And so the minority of us who understand that that's a dangerous fallacy must hold the Biden-Harris ticket's feet. Sorry. So the minority of us who understand that that's a dangerous fallacy must hold a Biden administration's feet to the fire and not sit back and sigh with relief that the monster Trump has been, has been defeated, because that monster is a hydra. And even if President Trump's head comes off, as it were, metaphorically, that network is regenerating and reconstituting and reconfiguring itself. And frankly, I think that a lot of the people who would be part of a Biden-Harris administration are people that I would consider either validators or enablers of, you know, the rule of kleptocratic networks. And that means a whole lot more work remains to be done. And it also means, in particular, and to take this conversation back to our, you know, our starting point, it means to resist the temptation to fall into identity politics. And that means a focus exclusively on the interests and advancement of particular identity groups, whether they be defined in political terms as blue, or whether they be defined in gender terms as women, or in racial terms, or in sexual orientation, or whatever. We've got to resist the temptation to elevate those identity, and especially the symbolic aspects of those identity issues, above the issues that unite all of us. And that may mean, you know, dressing differently. It may mean opening your environmental coalition to make it a comfortable home for hunters and fishermen. Because you know what? They really give a damn about the state of our forests and our rivers. And if we can make it possible for, you know, my neighbors in West Virginia to be part of our anti-fracking coalition, then we're going to get a whole lot further. But so long as, you know, we can be accused of only advancing the interests of urban, overeducated elites, we're never going to win. And that's going to be a really difficult effort. But let me turn around and say what's exciting about this is there's something for all of us to do. That's the final teaching of the Hydra myth. Eventually, Hercules was able to defeat the Hydra, but not alone, not alone. The guy with his club was not, you know, even Hercules could not all by himself defeat the Hydra. He needed his young, lithe nephew, the charioteer, Iolaus, who went and got a burning brand of pine tree to cauterize the necks of the Hydra. And for me, what that tells us is that every different type of talent is needed in this fight. There's something for all of us to do. Are we going to have to change the way we behave? Yeah, we sure are. Is that going to be a sacrifice? No, ma'am. No, ma'am. It turns out even people living through the aftermath of terrible crises acknowledge that that moment of shared purpose was one of the high points of their lives. If we can find that feeling of shared purpose, and if we can take on these kleptocratic networks from a lot of different angles, and that means public protest, it means, you know, legal and judicial reform, it means boycotting certain private sector strands of the networks, both to support, for example, antitrust and anti-monopoly legislation and enforcement, but also simply to make it easier for smaller businesses to survive. Yeah, walk an extra mile and go to that small business that you then have some oversight over instead of Amazon. There are places where you can't. I mean, we all are subject to a very small number of, for example, communications infrastructure companies. But that's where public policy comes in. We have to demand that these companies not enjoy the type of monopoly domination that they currently have. Same with food. You know, Tyson's and Purdue, they reduce our fellow American citizens to slavery, to the equivalent of indentured servitude. It's a disgrace. We shouldn't eat the cheap food they're peddling. So I think there are some consumer boycotts that can play in. I think we've talked a lot about how people of ideas have a very important role to play, but it's going to have to involve them, you know, hanging up the mantle of expertise and learning how to talk in ways that regular people can understand and helping guide regular people to a mastery of these concepts that kleptocratic networks are using to disenfranchise American citizens. And, you know, there's artistic and cultural stuff that needs to be part of this. There's something for everyone to do. And what I'm urging you to do, I mean, and I do detail a lot of it in my epilogue. I really tried to put as many ideas as I could come up with. And I, in the end, decided not to prioritize them or say this is more important than that or say, you know, here is the perfectly executed, perfectly and 3, 2, 1, and say, you know, here's the perfectly drafted blueprint for exactly how we're going to take these guys down. I decided not to go that way and just try to put as much in there that could appeal to as many different types of talents and inclinations as possible, because we are all going to have to get into this fight.
Well, Sarah, you're covering a lot of ground, a lot of inspiration. Greatly enjoyed reading your book, and I think it's, how would I say, something that is so germane and important for our times. As I was listening to you, sometimes in my mind, I hear musical lyrics. I was listening, and you were talking about a Democratic Biden administration, and I could imagine them walking out on stage with Carly Simon singing, "These Are the Good Old Days."
Right.
And all of the false, the dangers that that mindset might encourage. But I did remember about 3 years ago, I read a poem to a group of people in Bruges, Belgium, about what you might call the enchantment of mammon, about the love of money, about the kleptocratic networks. It was by a man named Isaac Watts, and in the title of the poem is False Greatness. Milo forbear to call him blessed, that only boasts a large estate, should all the treasures of the West meet and conspire to make him great. I know thy better thoughts, I know, the reason can't descend so low. Let a broad stream with gold sands through all his meadows roll. He's but a wretch with all his lands that wears a narrow soul. He swells amidst his wealthy store and proudly poising what he weighs. In his own scale he fondly lays huge heaps of shining ore. He spreads the balance wide to hold his manors and his farms, and cheats the beams with loads of gold he hugs between his arms. So mount the plowboy, climb a tree, when Croesus mounts his throne, and both stand up and smile to see how long their shadows grown. Alas, how vain their fancies be to think that shape their own. Thus mingled still with wealth and state, Croesus himself can never know. His true dimension and his weight are far inferior to their show. Were I so tall to reach a pole or grasp the ocean with my span, I must be measured by my soul. I think that you've unmasked, deepened, explored, created both intellectual and emotional connection to so many of the challenges that face us. I want to, on behalf of my listeners and myself and the Institute for New Economic Thinking, thank you for being our guest today, and I look forward to discussions again with you in the near future.
Rob, I can't thank you enough for all the work you've done and continue to do, both on your own and through INET. You're the shoulders that anyone else may be trying to stand on. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I'm just going to remind you with a little tease here that I was one of those guys that pulled the trigger on the British pound devaluation at Soros Fund Management in 1992. So maybe there's hope for us all.
Well, I mean, you know, I actually think there's a really important point there. FDR was a member of that, you know, group too, at least by birth. I actually think that the cross-cutting coalition, I actually think that the cross-cutting egalitarian coalition doesn't win without some important defections from the kleptocrats, you know, or from the group, the elite group that surrounds the kleptocratic network. So don't be embarrassed about that. We needed you because, you know, first of all, we need people who know how it operates and how it functions and what language it speaks. But without those defections, it's doomed. And I'm not sure, I wonder, and I would love to hear your thoughts on, who are the likely defectors today?
Yeah.
Do you have any, do you see any?
I see a number of people. Chuck Collins, who's, I think, at the Institute for Policy Studies in recent years. I mentioned Dennis Kelleher earlier. I see a number of people in the Silicon Valley realm that are quite conflicted in trying to move to a more enlightened place. I'll even add George Soros. You know, when we knocked off the British pound, George said to me, I was relatively new there. I'd just been there for a few months. And he said, don't get a big head. Stay away from real estate developers and art dealers. And don't pretend that because of this, that St. Peter would let you into heaven. You still got good things to do that you have to do. And by the way, in the weeks after the British pound devaluation, where he was supposedly the man who broke the British pound and made $1 billion in a day, he gave $250 million to Soviet scientists because he thought he could save the world billions of dollars if he could arrest nuclear proliferation.
Yeah, that's the fantasy that all these philanthropists have. Let me break the system by how I make my money and then spend some money to try to fix it.
Yeah, and maybe there's, how would I say, there are a lot of false rituals embedded in that. There are a lot of tricksters embedded in that.
Yeah.
But there can be, how would I say, people who cross the line. But I think where it gets, I want to ask you this, not say this, but it feels to me like where it breaks the line is when you leave that appetite for material
that
accumulation
exactly
and accomplishment
right.
and part to be start to become a part of a collective purpose rather than an individual
That's
purpose.
That's exactly right. And I think that, again, in On Corruption, I trace this passing of the generations that I think was forced by the calamities. But where I found Joe Kennedy to be a really fascinating character because he still had the old Gilded Age mentality, but he was born at the cusp where the values started shifting. Whereas you take an FDR, who I think was approximately contemporary of Joe Kennedy, and he had that more public ethos. So Joe Kennedy tried to mimic it and failed because he didn't have it. He couldn't fake it. But FDR actually truly had, I think, a valuing of public purpose rather than personal advancement.
Yeah, and his wife contributed to that consciousness mightily.
She was
very, and after his death was also a tremendous influence on President Truman and others.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Thank you, Rob. This was amazing.
Well, how do I say, we all learn a lot from being around people like you.
Well, vice versa.
And I look forward to our next occasion to chat.
Me
again.
Too. Please don't forget to send me the references to a couple of books, one being The Seasons of Grace, but I think there was maybe another one or two that you mentioned. Just the reference is fine. And also to your Young Scholars thing, because there's some people I want to circulate that with who don't know that it exists. And I actually know, I've got a friend who, kind of mentors a similar group focused in a Central American business school. It's called INCAI, is the school, but this is, they call it the Oath Club, where they all take an oath to place certain principles ahead of Mammon. And I think he might be really interested to see how they might be able to interact with INET's International
That'd
Young Scholars Program. So please do follow up with those. And I'm going to write to Bill. You know, I've never seen the Campbell interviews. I've only read Campbell. And I'm going to write to Bill and ask if he can make them available, because so many people have their
I might be. I have them in a Dropbox.
Do you?
I'll send you a link. Yeah.
Oh my goodness!
I got to turn off our recording here.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it, and reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.